Welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Taylor Velazquez. Across the country, over 90 million people have been diagnosed with COVID-19. While some people get better after a few weeks, some are still experiencing persistent symptoms months after an infection. Research is still going on and many experience a range of symptoms, but new data points to 1 in 8 COVID patients developing long COVID. The U.S. Health and Human Services Department now recognizes long COVID could be considered a disability as it limits major life activities. As for a recent update from the New Mexico Department of Health, COVID in New Mexico is stable, but we're still seeing high level of cases. Since the beginning of the pandemic, patients were warning the medical community and society about the potential of mass disabling impact of COVID-19. We've seen long haulers be diagnosed with severe illnesses like chronic fatigue syndrome, damage to major organs like heart and kidneys, and neurological disorders such as brain fog and brain damage. And after a COVID diagnosis in February of this year, I'm also still struggling with various long-term symptoms. Patient-led advocacy has still been on the forefront of this pandemic response. They suggest that if our system had been prioritized on research like chronic illness before the pandemic, then we should be more prepared for long COVID now. The healthcare system was already overwhelmed from the pandemic. Now that a new surge of chronically ill patients seeking help for long COVID, this could further strain our healthcare system. This morning, we'll be taking a look at what the future of our healthcare system is, given this new reality. And we want to hear from you. Are you dealing with lingering COVID symptoms? How is it impacting your ability to get care and to work? Are your health providers helping you and getting this response and care? Email us at letstalk@kunm.org, call us at 505-277-5866, or tweet to us with the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. My first guest this morning is Tanya Chavez, nurse practitioner and disability advocate. Welcome to the show, Tanya.
Thank you.
And you've been on the forefront fighting this pandemic. What does dealing with the stress of taking care of people look like for you and your colleagues?
Well, you know, different people deal with the stress differently. Some people are able to focus on the task at hand, and then they go home and they're exhausted, and sometimes they don't have enough energy to give to their families or to the rest of their life. And other people just feel very stressed while they're at work.
That sounds a lot like the professional burnout, not having the energy to do your profession while also not having it in your personal life. And, you know, we've heard from many different professions that people are dealing with that. Have you seen people leave the medical field because of the COVID impact?
Well, I have seen a few people change their trajectories, and some of it has been due to COVID, and some of it has been due to the fact that they were already close to the end of their careers, and so they just opted to go ahead and leave gracefully.
And now you're dealing with patients who are also dealing with chronic illness and needing that continuous care. Are you worried about keeping up with the standard of care while being inundated with more patients than ever?
Well, it's very interesting in a rural state such as New Mexico, where we have always had issues with access to care. So many of our patients with chronic disease have had difficulty getting access to care because of where they live and where the care providers are. And fortunately, in New Mexico, we already started building in some systems for helping to deal with that. And the greater implementation of telehealth has really increased the ability to have access to care for those people that are very distant from care providers. The problem is, if you have somebody that really needs a hands-on assessment, you just are not able to listen to lungs over the computer. You're not able to listen to someone's heart over the computer. You can talk to them, talk symptoms, take a look at what they need, and help them to implement other aspects of care. You can write orders, but you really need to have a person in front of you in order to meet their needs.
And that's what we're really looking at today, is how long COVID can look so different from person to person. And in your personal practice, how has long COVID shown up in your patients?
Well, I work with pediatrics, and so one of the very fortunate things is that the adolescents I work with generally are really quite strong. They generally do not have a lot of those long-term impacts, but I did work for a time in one of the emergency pop-up hospitals here in New Mexico that was run by the state, and some of those people were really quite stunned at the impact that COVID had on them. You know, they were very, very active. They were very healthy. They were accustomed to being able to do everything that they wanted to do. And when they caught COVID, then for weeks to months, they were having trouble even being able to walk at a regular pace while on oxygen.
Wow. And you know how long COVID has affected so many people in their daily lives and their routine. You're also an advocate for disability rights. Have you always been an advocate, or was this something that you were passionate about because of what you were seeing in your patients?
Oh, I've always been an advocate for disability rights. It's really very important to me. And one of my focuses has been mental health. And one thing that I noticed with my patients is that existing mental health conditions can be exacerbated by COVID. And I think we just don't know right now how far-reaching that will be. But in short to medium term, it really can exacerbate those conditions, and then it makes it much more difficult for those patients to be able to get the care that they need, because that is simply a hallmark of mental health conditions.
And you're unique in a way. So how does your advocacy really affect your job as a nurse practitioner when you're seeing these patients right in front of you?
Well, you know, one of the big things that I've always said is that we will see people with disabilities throughout life. It's not like people are separated and you only will encounter people with mental health issues in the behavioral health unit and people with lung issues at the pulmonologist. Those people come to you where in every situation. People with schizophrenia still catch pneumonia. People with lung issues still break their legs.
And
you know, we see them everywhere, and we need to be able to meet their needs no matter what kind of services they're seeking.
And you just mentioned so many cases of how people need care and different amounts of care, but right now in our healthcare system, what needs to change in order for doctors and nurses to be healthy enough to provide the care and for patients to get the care they need for their symptoms?
Wow. Well, that is the question of the hour, isn't it? A lot of things need to happen, and we need to make sure that we are able to care for our care providers and make sure that they have not only the resources that they need to meet the needs of their patients, but also the support that they need, the emotional and professional support that they need to be able to meet their own needs. Because in the end, you always have to put on your own oxygen mask first.
And that's so right. And what do you think we need to do in order to make sure our healthcare system can really have enough caretakers to handle these people in these cases?
Oh, boy. Well, so a lot of the programs are very rigorous, and we need to make sure that we are educating enough care providers and that we're providing support for people that are going into the profession to really be able to do the coursework so that they can enter into the profession. And frankly, we need to be kind to our new people that are entering into the profession. There's a saying that nurses eat their young, and we need to stop doing that. We need to care for one another and remember that we all start at the beginning and we progress through and gain skills. And the only way that we can really feel supported is by having the support of our peers.
I would like to now introduce my guest, Beatrice Adler-Bolton. She is an artist, writer, and a disability justice advocate who's also dealing with chronic illness. She also co-hosts the Death Panel podcast. Good morning, Beatrice. Thanks for being on the show.
Hi, Taylor. Thank you so much for having me.
And before we jump into the larger conversation of long COVID, I want to talk more about chronic illness. Before 2020 and the pandemic hit, what was it like trying to find adequate doctors and treatment for chronic illness and disability?
Well, before the pandemic, it was a very common experience for people who were seeking a diagnosis for chronic illness to spend many, many years going to a range of doctors, making the rounds, ruling things out, you know, sort of being not believed by some people, passed around. It's a really long process that is expensive and it takes up a lot of time. And after the pandemic hit, it not only slowed that down for the people who are in the process of seeking diagnosis for chronic illness, but also we've had so many more people join the ranks of the chronically ill because of long COVID. And so I think what we're going to see is that we're going to see much longer wait times that were already really bad. You know, if you were trying to get into a rheumatologist, it could take up to 6-8 months. The process of getting diagnosed, I think we think of it as a kind of immediate thing. But in reality, before the pandemic, it took a lot of time and it took a lot of work on the patient's end to coordinate all of the sort of decentralized, disparate systems of the healthcare apparatus within the United States to sort of pull together a diagnosis. And this can take, again, years. And now with the pandemic, both slowing down care, people have delayed care, more people need care. It's kind of a perfect storm where we have a lot of demand and we already didn't have enough providers to actually support the amount of people who need care in the United States.
And that's my next question for you. You're mentioning so many people before the pandemic who needed care, delayed their care, not getting the care, but we're also seeing more people than ever access the healthcare system. Is our healthcare system prepared for treating people? Are we moving to try to increase that preparedness? Or what's your thoughts?
I don't think that we're prepared, to be honest, Taylor. And I know that that's a very scary reality to accept because a lot of people with chronic illnesses have been suffering for a long time and need care. And there are a lot more people with chronic illnesses now than there were 5 years ago. It really worries me to go on Reddit and see nursing threads and boards talk about feeling like they are looking into the imminent collapse of our healthcare system. I think it's very clear. It was clear before the pandemic that we needed a change in the way that we distribute health resources and that ways that we finance healthcare in the United States needed to change. But with COVID, what we have now is all this additional pressure that's been put on the system. So everything that was already at its breaking point has been pushed and strained to the point that it's affecting health outcomes. It's making it harder for people to get care. And frankly, the working conditions for people who are working in these industries have gotten deplorable. I mean, we are treating workers like they are disposable. We are treating patients like they are disposable. And no one is getting what they need right now.
Right. And people who were chronically ill are now trying to have to be their own advocates. But now people with COVID are doing the same exact thing. And it's doctors on doctors. Do you think people are having to bankrupt themselves to get the care they need?
Oh, I'm sure it's absolutely happening. There's an idea within how we think about the social determinants of health, which are all the things beyond traditional healthcare that impact your health, like your housing, like the quality of the air, access to public transportation, whether or not you are living in a neighborhood with high COVID spread. These are all the kinds of things that impact your health. And what we've really seen is that this idea called financial toxicity.
And I'm going to have to interrupt you right there, Bea. Unfortunately, we have to take a break. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9. I'm Taylor Velazquez. We're talking about long COVID and disability rights. We'll be back in a moment.
Programs like the one you're listening to right now are made possible by contributions from KUNM members. Thank you for your trust and support and for being a part of the KUNM donor community. KUNM, powered by you.
Connect to your local community by becoming a KUNM business underwriter. Program support through underwriting highlights your business while supporting news and locally curated music. To become a business underwriter, contact Kelly at 505-277-3969.
Camille Saint-Saëns wrote this, his Danse Macabre, but this is a wildly creative new version for two pianos, violin, and percussion. I'm Fred Child. Join me for a special performance by the Anderson & Rowe duo and friends on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Taylor Velazquez. We're taking your calls about long COVID, disability, and the healthcare system. Are you a healthcare worker treating people with long COVID or even experiencing it yourself? Give us a call at 505-277-5866 and let us know, or you can give us an email at letstalk@kunm.org. And I want to go back to our guest, Beatrice Adler-Bolton. We were talking about patients having to be their own advocate, go to doctors on doctors on doctors to get the care. And people are basically financially bankrupting themselves, right?
Right. No, absolutely. The process of getting care is really long, but it's also really expensive. I mean, you have co-pays, you have the patient responsibility for prescriptions, and there's also the expensive time that starts to add up. And there's this concept called financial toxicity, which talks about the ways that these financial burdens of accessing care have knock-on health effects of their own. So it's not just that people with long COVID now and people who are chronically ill have this financial burden, but this financial burden also makes them sicker. And this is, I think, one of the biggest problems that we'll be facing going forward, because for a lot of people right now who are chronically ill and who may be considering if they need to go on disability, their work status is going to really be a huge sort of aspect of what they need to access care, but it's also going to get in the way of a disability application, because so much of disability is oriented around whether you can work or not. So a big problem in people in the chronic illness community is this trying to balance, you know, needing to care for yourself and needing to pay for your care. And that's very hard.
And it seems like we can maybe prevent this long-term disability with long haulers by preventing transmission rates. And we saw at the beginning of the pandemic and a little bit throughout that health officials are driving home the importance of masking and social distancing. But now we're seeing those mask mandates lift and the funding from Congress not being able to sustain things like testing, test sites, vaccines. What do you make of us treating the pandemic like it's over now when people are still getting sick and dealing with these long-term ramifications?
We can pretend that the pandemic is over, but that doesn't make it over for anyone that is experiencing it in their day-to-day life. And I think one thing that makes me really heartened and gives me a lot of hope is we're seeing studies that show that if people can take time off from work after they get sick, if they can rest, you're much less likely to develop long-term symptoms of COVID. And I think what we have now is ultimately not just an indictment of our healthcare system not being prepared to support people with chronic illnesses, but we also have a problem with the way that we pay for workers to take time off in this country. We don't have paid leave in the United States. And a lot of people who have long COVID because they've been forced back to work too soon. Not only is this going to exacerbate people's symptoms, but as you're saying, you know, this is going to continue to push spread in the community. And every single layered protection is just one more layer that we need to try and keep everyone safe from COVID. We can't protect ourselves using personal responsibility. We can't protect ourselves using one-way masking. We need to return to the frameworks of solidarity and community protection and recognize the fact that if we're going to live with COVID, this is something that we all have to do together. This is not just a burden on the vulnerable. This is a collective project that we need to work on. And that's also going to involve like commitments from the federal government that they're currently unwilling to make. This is why I appreciate long COVID advocacy, because I think that is a really important avenue for putting the kind of pressure we need to get the funding behind programs like standing backup testing. And I think also making sure that we're doing an adequate response to the monkeypox epidemic, which currently right now we have a situation where vaccines are being rationed against the FDA orders for how they're supposed to be administered. And so I think what we have right now is a sort of moment where the federal government wants to step away from pandemic protections and make this a private issue of the private market. And the fact of the matter is, this is a population level phenomenon. This is in the air. We can't do that yet, and we have to keep pushing.
We've seen COVID really be politicized, and some people are pointing to our midterm elections happening throughout the country. How do you think politics is impacting COVID policy now?
I think politics is always going to impact our infectious disease policies, our healthcare policies, and how we talk about health in this country. There's never a moment where politics is going to be separate. However, what we have right now is COVID used as a rhetorical political tool right now. There's the framework that's been very widespread. You hear this all over the place, that people are just done with COVID. And it's become framed as this election issue. And frankly, right now, what we have, I think, is a moment where the kind of the idea of people being done with COVID is very big and present. But if you talk to people on the street, if you talk to your neighbors, your coworkers, the people in your life, they're not done with COVID. They feel abandoned. They feel forced to protect themselves, and they are put under financial stress because they're having to do this out of their own pocket. And I think we need to be real about what the privatization of the COVID response means. And it means more financial burden on the working class, more sickness for all of us. And I don't think that we have to consent to this. I think that there are ways that we can live with COVID that are much safer than the way that we are approaching it with now.
And as I mentioned earlier, you are a co-host of the Death Panel podcast, and you all have a saying that is stay alive another week. Can you talk about this a little more? How did we get to this place in society?
Well, this is something that I say at the end of every one of our episodes, because I think it's difficult for people who are chronically ill to live under capitalism and live under our system of healthcare in the United States, which is, as we've been talking about, very expensive, full of administrative burdens, and very difficult. And I think for a lot of people in that community, 1 week at a time is as much as we can take. And so when we say stay alive another week, we're trying to sort of talk about both how we have to think about long-term goals and long-term changes that we want to all make to our society to have better lives. But we also have to, you know, take care of ourselves in the short term. And that's a really important thing to remember and a really important balance to strike, I think, especially in COVID advocacy, because you have a lot of people who are themselves chronically ill, who are working, trying to pay for their appointments, trying to get care, get diagnosed. And on top of that, they're doing advocacy. And it's really important not to burn out, because this is a long struggle and a long fight. And so when I say at the end of every episode, stay alive another week, I try and remind everyone that we're all in this together. And it is a long struggle, but we are struggling towards health justice for the United States. And that's a really wonderful thing.
And I would like to introduce my next guest, Dr. Vesta Sandoval, Chief Medical Office at Loveless Healthcare System, New Mexico. Welcome to the show, Dr. Sandoval.
Thank you, and thank you for asking me to be here this morning.
Of course, and after listening to Bia's testimony of stay alive another week and how we really could come together as a community, Is this what you're seeing in your patients and in the medical field?
Yes, I think it's very important for us to realize, and one point I really want to highlight that she touched on is, what can we do in the short term? What are the ways that we can manage long COVID? And then what are the things that are being done for long-term help for patients? And I think it's important that when we look at this, we understand that this is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, when they're estimating numbers of people that will have long COVID or potentially could have long COVID, we're looking at anywhere between 5 to 27 million people in the United States. So what we're talking about is a new healthcare crisis. You know, these are people that are now potentially less productive, unable to do the things that they did in their life previously. So, you know, we really have to focus in and try to develop research studies and ability to understand more about long COVID. Part of the problem with long COVID is that it's difficult to define. And so the studies have been lagging behind somewhat. But I did want to highlight a few studies that are ongoing, one of which is an NIH four-year research project looking at patients that are not COVID positive, that following them through the entire process if they become positive, and then what the outcomes are.
And pointing to CDC data from June, that it shows that 7.5% of adults in the U.S. have markers of long COVID. Researchers and doctors are still not sure on how to agree on defining long COVID. What definition are you and your colleagues using?
That's correct. It is difficult to define, but there was a recent study that was just done in the British Medical Journal that looked at basically three different types of subcategories of long COVID. And one was the neurologic issues that we see, and that has to do with kind of the brain fog, depression, headache sorts of issues. Another was more of the respiratory, shortness of breath and cough. And then the third was really more of physical conditions, issues that deal with muscle pain, fatigue, hair loss, those types of issues that are more physically related. And what they're trying to do is really take those subcategories and understand why some patients develop one subtype more than others. And so there are research studies right now. For instance, there's a study that's being done with mice looking at inflammatory changes in the lung and how those develop, and then what are the possible treatments for that. There's another study that's been undergoing in the British Medical Journal as well. It's not released yet, but what they're looking at there is they're looking at the changes in PET scans for patients that have had COVID and looking at inflammatory changes in the brain. And there was also another additional study where they looked at this one I like because I thought this was very interesting. They took MRIs from patients 3 years ago pre-COVID. And then after COVID, they had the repeat MRI. And they're looking at changes in the brain and trying to correlate that some with neurocognitive testing. So there's a lot of research to try and understand which subcategories people develop and why, and then potentially understand why it is someone is developing that so it can be targeted for treatment.
And I want to take a moment to pivot to at least a listener email from Jennifer. She says, as a New Mexican struggling with long COVID, I'm really struggling to find any coordinated resources for addressing the healthcare issues I'm now facing. I noted that you'll be chatting with Dr. Sandoval, and I'm curious to hear what she says about the Loveless post-COVID recovery program. As a Loveless patient, I recently called a number for that program. They then directed me to another number where the person who answered had no idea what I was talking about. My Loveless PCP seemed equally clueless about this program. Indeed, at my appointment earlier this month, she seemed to have no idea what to do with me or where to point me for help. Dr. Sandoval, what do you say to Jennifer in finding help at the Loveless program or just help overall?
Well, you know, again, I think that's unfortunate, and it just goes to show that there has to be further education and that we still have to press this issue so that primary cares and specialists understand what it is to deal with long COVID. And I would say one possible resource would be that there's a healthcare appointment checklist on the CDC website that helps guide patients in how to deal with healthcare workers and the questions to ask and then what information to bring. But I'm very glad Jennifer called and made the statement so that I can certainly get in there and correct any issues. And I apologize for that. But this is, again, this is something that we're just facing the tip of the iceberg of this issue. And it is something that medicine is going to be faced with down the road. We have to find ways to help these patients because this is not a small number of patients. And this is not something that's going to be rare. And we need to be able to help people understand what long COVID is and then how to treat it. You know, and up until just recently,
people were treating symptomatically,
trying to make people feel better for each particular symptom. And so this is, you know, part of the problem is that we need more research and we need more information to really help people.
And when people are struggling with being chronically ill, whether they were healthy before the pandemic and got just so many symptoms and now are dealing with disabilities, or people who were chronically ill before the pandemic, how can the medical community reach a consensus and recognize long COVID in patients in order to have a clearer recovery plan?
Well, I really believe it comes down to education and it comes down to having these discussions. I mean, the advocacy groups are great because they bring the problem to the forefront. They bring it out so that people have to hear and listen. But amongst the medical educators, you know, we need to have that information brought forward and discussed as well. I think that COVID itself, of course, it was, it came on like a storm. You know, we kind of weathered that initial storm, and now we have the long-term consequences, and we have COVID that we will deal with in the future going forward. I mean, we're still dealing with COVID now, and we're still hospitalizing patients. We're still taking care of patients trying to prevent COVID. And I think one of the biggest messages out there is if you become vaccinated, you're much less likely to develop long COVID. So receiving the vaccine series seems to be protective and is very helpful for preventing long COVID. Also, the more mild cases, so if you're receiving treatment like Paxlovid, then, you know, it potentially could help protect you from long COVID.
And I want to pivot this question back to Bia, who we were talking about earlier about chronic illness and patient advocacy group that in movement that we've seen through this pandemic. Do you think patients' voices in research studies, in collaborating with doctors, would be impactful moving forward?
Absolutely. It's essential. There's an idea called embodied expertise, and I think there's growing recognition of how important that is to our conceptualization of how we think about health and healthcare and illness in this country. And that means recognizing sick people as experts on themselves and on their own experience of illness. And I think this is something that, you know, the disability community and the chronic illness community for many, many decades now has been fighting this fight to push to be recognized as experts of their own lives. And I think this is something that we're seeing the long COVID advocacy groups embrace. And I honestly, I have so much hope from just thinking about how much further we can push research if we center people who actually are not just the bodies that we use for research, but the bodies that are supposed to benefit from it, not just, you know, as research subjects, but as people who really matter in directing what we're going to research and why. And this is something I think that many are taking inspiration from the HIV/AIDS movement and groups like ACT UP from the 80s and 90s. Who really pushed the boundaries of what a patient meant in terms of an expert. And I think that's what we're seeing now. And as I said, you know, it gives me a lot of hope.
Dr. Sandoval, you're seeing patients at Loveless Pulmonary Clinic. Are you seeing patients who have become, because of severe scar tissue or even other major complications, are having a hard time keeping up with the daily tasks they were doing before getting that initial COVID infection?
And I want to say I'm not actively seeing patients at this time because I'm the chief medical officer, but I would say that I know our clinic does see patients that have had long-term scarring in the lungs as a result of COVID. So it is definitely a side, I wouldn't say really a side effect, but it is a result of COVID. Lung scarring is something that you can see in patients having to use long-term oxygen therapy after COVID is not uncommon.
And we're going to have to take a break. We're talking about the long-term effects of long COVID on Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Taylor Velasquez, and we'll be back in a minute.
Newly acquired access to a collection of Pueblo pottery inspired a new museum exhibit that just opened in Santa Fe. It includes the perspectives and inspirations about the pots from Pueblo artists, tribal leaders, and others. We'll hear about Grounded in Clay, the spirit of Pueblo pottery, on the next Native America Calling.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
Really hung in there for that old car, through body damage, through the odometer turning over, until it's far from a meaningful trade-in. Through its refusal to run one more mile, you've pushed it, cursed at it, dumped money into it. What more can you do? Give it to KUNM. We'll take it off your hands and send you a tax deduction. Plus, your donation keeps great radio coming your way. Call 888-KUNM-CAR. That's 888-586-6227.
And welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM. We're looking at the effects of long COVID on our healthcare system and our workplaces. There's still some time to call in this morning at 505-277-5866. And I want to talk more to Dr. Sandoval from Loveless. When I'm doing research on long COVID and the impacts and the future of long COVID, people are pointing to the possibility of a generation of young people having chronic illness or having disabilities. Is this something that is fair to say?
I think it is. Like I said, I think it's very concerning just the sheer number of people that have long COVID symptoms. It is concerning for our healthcare industry. And in particular, younger children who experience severe COVID are much higher percentage-wise and much more likely to develop long COVID symptoms.
And I would now like to introduce my next guest, Elisa Valdez, long COVID survivor and author. Thanks for being on the show this morning.
Hi, thank you.
And last time we had you on the show, you spoke about your experiences of getting diagnosed with COVID. Now that you're 2 years out from your initial infection, how has it been interacting with doctors when it comes to your long COVID? Elisa, can you hear us?
Okay. Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. I'm trying to figure out how to do this because I have you both on Zoom in the call. The question was, how am I doing 2 years out?
Yes, and interacting with your doctors and trying to get all your symptoms heard.
Yeah. So I've had to leave the state of New Mexico. I'm now, to get any help at all that's good. I will say I had an enterprising doctor at Presbyterian who was helping me until the company basically told her and other doctors not to help people with long COVID. And I think we need to be really clear that that's what's going on. The private healthcare companies generally, at least in here, either don't know what long COVID is, they make excuses about it, or they don't want to help people because it's expensive. So I'm now a patient at a clinic in San Antonio, Texas, which is really wonderful. And I don't know what it's going to take. Every other state practically has, when Texas is doing better than New Mexico on healthcare, we have a problem. So it's been extremely demoralizing. It's amazing how many healthcare providers still have no idea what long COVID even is. we should not be having to educate them at this point. And it's also, I heard someone earlier say, well, we don't know what long COVID is. It's difficult to define. That is absolute nonsense. There are tens of thousands of studies about long COVID already. There are more studies of COVID than any disease that's ever existed. Furthermore, an amazing new study came out this week from, excuse me, from Akiko Iwasaki, who is a professor at Yale. And she found, she did a deep dive on the immunological biomarkers of long COVID, and there are many. The most telling one is cortisol. Cortisol levels are off in most people with long COVID. And one really important finding from her study, I would encourage everybody to go and look at it, especially any healthcare professionals who are listening. But a really important takeaway from her study was that people who self-report long COVID symptoms are, it's 99% or 95% correlated with these biomarkers. So doctors need to believe their patients.
And that's
one more thing. It's really important that doctors stop asking for positive COVID tests in long COVID patients. Especially in women and also because the rapid antigen tests and others are not as effective in women, and looking for COVID antibodies as proof that someone had COVID is also inappropriate for people who had long COVID, because especially in women, many times we're not producing the appropriate antibodies, which is why we have long COVID in the first place.
And that was my next question for you. You're having to document every single symptom that you're experiencing, whether it's a known symptom, it's widely out there that it could be a symptom. Do you feel like every time you go into a doctor's office, you're having to prove what you're experiencing?
Yes. Not only do you have to prove it, but I've had the most absurd things said to me, like that I should get on my knees and thank God that I never had COVID, from a doctor. And I don't want to get into sort of the resentment that I feel and that many of us feel having been gaslit, because it's a common experience. But also, you know, as Buddha said, you know, resentment is like holding onto a hot coal and hoping it burns someone else. It doesn't really do me any good. And a big part of recovery, I feel like at this point I am 99% recovered. And I would love, if possible, to share what it took for me to get here. And I don't think that can happen for everyone. But I do have lots of, you know, first wave long haul friends who got sick in March of 2020, who were really, really sick for 2 years. And several of us are starting to feel like we can get back to our lives and we're feeling better. But it took a lot of research on our own. It took a lot of community on our own. The Twitter long COVID universe, patients helping other patients, doctors who became patients, you know, then sort of realizing what was going on, and helping one another. So, yeah, it's frustrating, but you know what? There are good clinics. It's been such a relief to be at the San Antonio clinic, because not only did I not have to educate anybody about what was going on, they were educating me. The problem now, of course, is that they have prescribed treatments for me that I can't get here. So,
it sounds very frustrating, and I'm sorry you've had to go through all that, but it seems like there's light at the end of the tunnel for your case. But given that so many symptoms are invisible, are you feeling like it's difficult for doctors to even address those symptoms? Are you going back in time and looking at people with chronic illness who are also experiencing those invisible symptoms?
Yeah, you know, I think there's something genetic going on with the people who get long COVID that's connected, I think, to the immune system, because I did have ME/CFS after an illness for a couple of years in the mid-2000s. And the illnesses are similar, but not identical. The new study that I was talking about from Professor Iwasaki also shows some distinct patterns for long COVID that are not seen in ME/CFS. I know a lot of people have worked really hard to say that these two things are the same thing. They're not exactly the same thing, but we're definitely allies because of the gaslighting and the, you know, sweeping it under the rug. I think as a society, we put a lot of faith in authority generally. And I think the medical system falls into that. So people are putting a lot of authority, they grant a lot of authority to doctors who, frankly, in this instance don't deserve it. No, there's not a doctor alive who learned about long COVID in medical school. Okay, so if they don't know what long COVID is at this point, they probably need to leave the practice of medicine, because there are so many studies out. And I get it. You're busy. You're a doctor. Guess what? We are all also busy. But yeah, I don't think the terms mysterious and unknowable and difficult get thrown around with long COVID. And none of that is true when you consider that it is a vascular disease. It's a disease that is causing massive microclotting and damage. The microclotting is happening in the capillaries. Anywhere you have capillaries in your body, you can have damaged capillaries, clogged capillaries, and that is going to cause a problem. So our symptoms are very similar to vasculitis. Our symptoms also are very similar to FIP in cats and some vascular equine coronaviruses that cause vascular problems. People in the veterinarian world are not unfamiliar with what long COVID looks like. There's just no crosstalk between, you know, veterinarians and human doctors, which is ridiculous, really, if you think about the, you know, we have 90 some percent of our genes in common with several apes. I don't really have a lot of patience for doctors who don't know what's going on and who make people feel bad about their symptoms. And I know that, you know, many people have a hard time questioning doctors, confronting doctors. You want to believe them. You want them to help you, and you don't want them to dislike you. But if you are a patient and you have this, you're going to have to not only become your own advocate, which sucks when you're sick. Who has the energy for that? But you're also maybe going to have to go out of state and pay out of pocket. And how many of us can do that? Nobody.
And I want to talk to Bia real quick. You had mentioned in the chat here on Zoom that you also struggle with vasculitis. Did I say that right?
Yeah, vasculitis. Oh, yeah, it's a general umbrella for a group of conditions that are autoimmune diseases that affect the blood vessels in the body. And I have vasculitis, and I've had vasculitis for a long time. And one of the things that I think I just wanted to raise really quickly, Alyssa, I really appreciate what you were saying, and I think you're absolutely correct. But I'm someone with vasculitis with a rare disease. And one of the things that I had to sort of learn and embrace after many years of being a chronic illness patient was that there are a lot of unknowns, and there will always be a lot of unknowns. And I think this is something that we need to be working towards, trying to figure out a long COVID framework for. How can we challenge medical authority that denies people care while also acknowledging the fact that because of chronic illness, we can't rely on knowing things as the kind of leverage that we need to get people care. We have to basically, I think, be pushing towards thinking of ways to use social circumstances to diagnose people, to take more holistic approaches to how we're thinking about people's health. Because I think right now, you know, as you're saying, Alyssa, there's a huge administrative burden that's been placed on patients with long COVID, where people are asking for tests and documentation and proof. And I think we have to be pushing towards, as you're saying, this kind of perspective on long COVID, where we acknowledge that, you know, we're not going to know if someone has a test to correlate to their case. We're not going to have this kind of proof, but the symptoms, the experiences of patients, the experiences of everyone who is suffering right now, who's being ignored by their doctors, who's being, you know, denied care or, you know, sent doctor shopping because the, you know, the doctor isn't educated. You know, this is part of the fabric of chronic illness and how it works. And a lot of that has to do with finding ways to make decisions based on the information we have. And the information we have is that a lot of people have symptoms right now, and doctors need to accept that. And we need to come up with treatment frameworks to help support people. And we need to also, I think, expand our disability systems to make sure that we're accounting for what this is going to do in terms of people who are going to have to continue to work, who are also going to be disabled, because this is a huge problem. But I do think, like, pushing the angle of certainty is not necessarily something that's going to get us very far, because in this world, certainty is never real. It's never going to be there. And we can't hang our hopes on certainty being the thing that's going to guarantee us care, because we have to be willing to push forward regardless of that certainty.
And Dr. Sandoval, I want to go to you now. And what do you think about the experiences that both Bia and Elisa are facing right now?
You know, I think it's certainly unfortunate. I mean, most physicians go into medicine with the intent upon taking care of their patients, right? And when I sit with a patient, I'm listening to the patient, listening to their story, trying to do everything that I can to help the patient feel better, all right? No one intentionally wants someone to feel worse or feel bad. So, you know, physicians don't go, they don't spend all these years in training just to turn around and try and make people feel bad. So I understand people's frustrations. Certainly nothing about long COVID is perfect at this moment. So I really agree. We need a framework for treatment. We need a framework to be able to coordinate care. You know, there's the healthcare system has been challenged just by the sheer number of COVID patients and cases. And so, you know, we are catching up, but nobody is intentionally trying to cause anyone harm, and we want to help. So I think that's the message that people need to understand, is that, you know, some of these cases that people have experienced, you know, I wouldn't want to experience that myself. I wouldn't want any of my relatives to experience that. It's certainly not what we want. So, you know, the helpful thing is the advocacy. The helpful thing is for us to join together, work together. I think that the healthcare industry and physicians want to hear people's voices.
And Elisa, I want to know your thoughts on going through the system, having all these unknowns, but also wanting to seek results for your long-term COVID. What are you thinking about all of this?
Well, first, I do agree with B 100%. We can't count on sort of business as usual when it comes to chronic illness. And unfortunately, the medical system that we have is set up almost like the image that comes to mind for me, I feel like I'm talking to robots a lot of the time, where you feed them a list of symptoms, it goes through you don't even really need a person there, because they're kind of, their hands are tied, they go by whatever their HMO tells them. When you have this list of symptoms, then you give them this drug. That's about it. And I really think ignoring long COVID and the huge tsunami of long COVID, if there's a silver lining for me for this, it's that this is absolutely 100% going to deal a death blow to capitalist for-profit medicine. It has to.
And I do hear that music in the background telling us that, unfortunately, our time is up. But thanks to everyone who called and emailed to share your thoughts. And thank you so much to our guests, Elisa Valdez, Beatrice Adler-Bolton, Tanya Chavez, and Dr. Sandoval. It's a big topic, and I appreciate everyone trying to get those questions and answers out there. This show was made possible by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation and KUNM listeners like you. And let's keep the conversation going. Share your ideas on Twitter using the hashtag #LetsTalkNM, on Facebook, search for KUNM Radio, or email us on letstalk@kunm.org. Tune in next week, and we'll be talking about supporting loved ones with addiction. If you missed part of our show, stream it online or subscribe to our podcast. Our engineer is Marina Spencer. Jeanette DeDios screened your calls. Kaveh Movahed live tweeted. News director Megan Kamrick is our executive producer. And a special thanks to Jared Ebernreich. I'm Taylor Velazquez. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM.